My name is Frank Benson. I left school when I was 14 years old and I had to find a job. My father was Ernest Benson and he worked at Waterhate Colliery underground as a collier. And he always said that he vowed and declared that no son of his would go to work underground. So I came home one day and my father said, "You're going down to Colliery to meet Mr. Williams. He's promised you a job." So off I went down to the colliery and interviewed with Mr. Williams, and I got the job as an errand boy, which meant going, taking letters around and going over to the head officers at Whitwood, which was the head officers of Henry Briggs and Son. And I used to take the ledgers and time records, and I used to go over there every day. Also, my duties was to fetch the snaps of the foremen and under managers from their homes first thing on the morning. I'd bring them to the colliery and also call at the post office to fetch the colliery mail and take it to the colliery.
So you were 14?
I was 14 years old.
And this was 1943?
1943, September, yes.
And did you have any idea that you were going to get a job anywhere else before Ernest Benson said, "I've got this job for you"?
No. In those days, you did as your parents said and not what you wanted to do. Because later years, after working at the colliery for a time, well, I think it was, I'd be about 16 or 17, and they said they was transferring me into the time office to be an apprentice timekeeper and working with Mr. Charlie Anderson. And whilst I was on the job, I used to have to go across to the wagon way and collect things, and I used to go into different shops and offices and workshops, namely joiners' shop. And I used to get talking to joiners, and they said, "Why don't you come home?" I told them I'd like to work in woodwork. "Why don't you try and get a job in joiners' shop then?" When I tried, they said, "No, we want you in time office. You've trained in time office. There's no jobs in joiner's shop or anywhere else." So I had to stay where I was put.
So you kind of proved yourself in the clerical side?
In the clerical side as a timekeeper, yes. And that's where I stayed the rest of my life.
My name's Ken Watson. I was born in Swillington and I left school in 1953, not having any idea what type of job I was going to. And finally, my father suggested that I ought to write to the NCB, because he worked for the NCB on one of their farms. Anyway, I did do, and they offered me a job at Let's and Look. And I always remember the first job that I was given. It was changing the numbers in the telephone directory. And anyway, I did that, and because I could do shorthand and typing, I had a leaning to want to be a manager's clerk. Anyway, time went along, and on this particular Wednesday, a request come from area for me to go and work at area to be the area manager's clerk, except I couldn't do that because I was having to leave on the Wednesday night to go in the RAF on the Thursday morning to do my national service. So I went in the RAF and I worked in office work there. And then when I came out, things weren't as I expected. So I left and went to work for an oil company, which is also almost next door to Waterhaig. And I left there because I'd seen an advert in the paper for a manager's clerk at Waterhaig, just what I'd been wanting all the time. So I came to Waterhaig as a manager's clerk.
And was that because it was better pay than at the oil company?
It didn't even bother me. I wanted to be a manager's clerk at the pit because I always liked the atmosphere of the pit. Anyway, I came to Waterhaig as manager's clerk, and I was there until about 1962, and then I got a promotion as the group manager's clerk at West Riding Pit. And in due course, it closed down, did the West Riding Pit, and I got the offer to be the chief clerk at Wateraig, which I thoroughly enjoyed working at Wateraig, so I came back to Wateraig as the chief clerk until the pit closed in 1970, and that I was the last clerical person to actually work here.
Effectively, you were both on the clerical side, and Frank was 10 years ahead of you, Ken.
Yes, that's right. I mean, I met Frank when I first came to Wateraig. He was in the time office, I was in the manager's clerk upstairs, and, you know, we sort of all worked together as a group of clerical people.
So back in 1943, when you were just turned 14, and you came to work here, can you describe what it looked like?
Well, I can only say it looked like a colliery. You came down off the Fleet Lane, which is one of the main roads in Oulton, turned left into the colliery grounds, and you looked straight ahead and saw the number one headgear, which was straight forward. As you come down the road, it was straight in front of you. On the right-hand side, you passed the pithead baths. Then, on the left-hand side, there was a big building. The lower part was more or less garages and one or two offices. And upstairs, it was the colliery canteen was there then. Where I worked was the next building along on the right-hand side, after you'd passed the colliery baths, was the main office block. At the end, nearest to where you turned in, was the time office. And the next office, with a weighbridge outside, was the colliery weigh office. And this were all on the ground floor. Also on the ground floor was the head clerk's office, and next to that was the pay office, where they used to pay the man's wages out. We had a massive safe in there, and then you go upstairs. You went upstairs. The first office on the right-hand side was the draftsman's office, or the colliery surveyor's office. Then at the end, with a window on the corner, looking out, we could see everybody that came down the colliery into the colliery premises, was the manager's office. At that time, Mr. Williams, W.B. Williams, and adjoining his office in the corner, the other corner, was the manager's clerk's office.
Now, we're standing here at the junction of Fleet Lane and the road into where the pit was. Yes. Did this little side road have a name of its own?
Not to my knowledge, just the colliery, just entrance to the colliery. I don't think it had a name.
You said the headgear. What do you mean by the headgear?
The winding gear that sent the cages down to the pit bottom to take the men down first thing on the morning and bring them up later in the day, after they'd done 7 1/4 hours. And it also used to fetch the coal in tubs out of the pit. The empty tubs went in at one side and the full tubs out at the other side, and then they went to over another little weighbridge, what was called the Checkwayman's Bridge, and all these tubs used to have a little motty number on, and that motty number denoted who had filled that coal down in the colliery.
And so the men got paid by the amount of coal that came out,
yes.
What does motty mean?
Motty, it's just another name for a number. Sometimes they used to stick a label on with the motte number on, and others had proper checks.
So the headgear was on top of the shaft. Yes. That's what a traditional picture of a colliery would be. Was there any other shaft? Was there only the one big shaft here?
There was a downcast shaft, what they call a downcast shaft, and an upcast shaft. We had two at Wateraig, number one shaft and number three. Don't ask me where number two got to, because I don't know. But there was number three shaft, I think, was the upcast shaft. This is for the air circulation down the colliery. It went in down the number one shaft and circulated all around the colliery and then came out up number three shaft. And number three shaft also used to drive men down to get to their districts. But it didn't bring the coal out of the colliery. It all transported out of number one.
So there was a number three shaft, which also had colliery headgear,
yes,
in a different place to the number one shaft.
It was just to the... as you stand looking at the colliery, it was to the right of the number one shaft. And in between there, underground, well, it was underground, was the boiler house, big boilers, where they used to get this power for running the colliery, colliery headgears.
So the headgear engine was actually a steam engine, yes, in those days?
There was a powerhouse just in front of the headgear, the big powerhouse with the big drums on, the cables, and then there was a powerhouse as well in front of number three for the same reason, and they were all powered by the steam from the boilers.
So that one engine house drove the winding gear for both shafts?
No, well, the boilers did, but they'd a separate
cable, engine.
Drum house where the cables went, powerhouse.
In those days in 1943, this is before the collieries were nationalised, which was 1948.
Yes.
So who owned this pit and how many men worked here?
I wouldn't like to say how many men worked, but the collieries were owned by Henry Briggs and son. We had an agent, Mr. Dennis Hargreaves. They always used to call him Mr. Dennis, and he lived at a big house in the village, which was called Eshold House.
And he was the boss then?
He was the full boss of Waterhague. It was part of the Hargreaves family that owned the Henry Briggs and son. Then there was Mr. Williams, W.B. Williams, who also lived at Eshold House in another section, like a flat below Mr. Dennis's.
So this Mr. Williams was the manager in private ownership days before nationalisation?
In private ownership, yes. And his father also worked at the colliery. They called him Frank Williams, and he was under manager.
But so his son ended up being his boss then?
Well, his son was his boss, yes.
Yeah, right.
W.B. Williams, they called him.
When you were in the offices in those days, what was the atmosphere like? Because it was the middle of the Second World War. Was there a lot of coal being dug out?
Oh, yes, they were still producing coal. No miner had to go into services.
So on a normal day then, what did you do?
Every district, every deputy down pit had a book and with all the names who were under his charge. And he used to tick off, put them a stroke in if they'd come that particular day. We used to send all these books down the pit in big leather cases. And then at the end of the shift, they'd all come out and we would check those books with the lampman's return and check if they'd all been, definitely been, and then we'd enter them on our records in the time office, the number of hours they'd been down. Well, the 7 1/4 hours was the statutory time. If there were any worked overtime, well, we had to pay them extra overtime. When a miner came, presented himself for work at the colliery, he first had to go to the lamp room. He had to hand a cheque in for his lamp. He used to get his lamp, and the lampman would give him two cheques.
These are little bits of
little
metal?
Brass metal discs with his number on. When he went up to where they went down the cage, up the pit hill, pit bank, as we called it, there was a chap there that was called an onsetter, and he used to take a cheque off the men when he went down, and then those cheques would come back to us to check with the records to make sure that we'd got everybody down so that they knew at any time who was down the colliery. And then when they came out, the other cheque that they got, two cheques from the lamp room, when they came out of the colliery, they had to give them the cheque in when they got onto the cage again, and those cheques all came out.
So this cheque had a unique number for each miner, and they kept that number when they were working at the pit?
They kept that number all the time, yes.
So if your name was Smith and you had a number 120, you always were Smith 120.
That was Smith 120, definitely. And unless you left and that were it, then it'd go to somebody else with that number.
And your job was to record when they went down the pit and when they came out.
When they came out, yes.
And they got paid by the hours that they were down there, and then you said...
Seven and a quarter hours was a standard rate of hours to be down the colliery for a worker.
And then they got paid more the more coal they dug out. Is that how it works?
There was a system, yardage system, that came in. The cubic yards. A deputy used to have to measure what had been cut that day and how much coal had been filled off. And then there would be a team of men, and at end of the week they'd ascertain how much coal had come out from their district.
And so that team had a certain amount of money divided up amongst the workers.
They were all what they called a butty system, and there was a chap in charge of them. This is going back to the early days. They used to have a pot of money, and this chap used to share it out between his gang of workers, and it keeps so much for himself. I suppose he'd keep bigger share. I don't know, but that's how they used to work it, until later on when it were all done by yardage and every miner was paid the same that worked on the district.
Ken, what was it like when you arrived in 1953? Was it much the same as it had been 10 years before?
Well, by 1953, nationalisation had taken place, and on the 1st of January 1947... And as a nine-year-old boy, I remember standing in a field where my father was working and the flag being hoisted up to the top of the flagpole in CB. I mean, it was supposed to be the answer to get pits to produce much more coal, which was really needed in the post-war period. But it's interesting what Frank said about the two shafts. Every pit had to have a second means of egress, i.e. a second shaft. So if one shaft was blocked, there was another way out. But then someone had the great idea that if on one shaft we have a fan that's sucking the air out of the pit, it will automatically suck the air down the other one, which is fresh air. So it had two purposes. It was pulling the foul air out of the pit and pulling the fresh air down the pit, and that's how the ventilation was in the pit. And you know, some people might think, well, why did I want to work at a pit? It had something about it. It was rough, but, you know, lots of dust. But I always had the greatest respect from day one when I started at the pit for the miners. And there was steam oozing out all over from the winders and that, you know. And because their speed relied on how much steam they could get. And if the winding engine man wasn't making enough ropes, that was the number of ropes per hour that was up and down in an hour, which was about sort of in the 17. The manager says, how many ropes have you done in the last hour? He'll say 69. He says, that won't do. So he had to contact the men in the boilers, which was a dreadful job, to get more coal on the boilers, to produce more steam, so we could go faster on the shaft for getting more coal out.
Tell us a bit more about what was underground. How many seams of coal and what kind of coal was underground here?
There were three seams here. There was the Middleton Little,
Flockton.
The Flockton, and the 11-yard seam. There were the three.
Come closer.
Yeah. There were three seams. And, of course, one seam went sort of that way, another seam went that way, and because there was almost collieries about every couple of mile, and they all sort of worked to the boundary of the other colliery, and that worked to the boundary of the colliery after that, and it was.
And these seams were at different levels underground, weren't they?
They're all at different levels with those
different thicknesses,
and that was interesting. Some men who had been used to working on very low seams, and we're talking of low seams of about 24 inches, couldn't work in high seams stood up because they'd always been used to working knelt down, and vice versa, of course. The men who worked in high seams couldn't cope with the low seams. So it was horses for courses sort of, and, And
so we had some seams that were about 2 feet deep, and then others that were much taller than that.
Well, much taller. I think the probably tallest one here at Water Egg would be about 3 foot, 3 foot 6. Now, when you sort of went into the Kellingleys and Selby Coalfields, you were talking about six feet or more, you know, where you just stood up and worked, sort of. But, I mean, even lower than this, you go the Waterloo Colliery that this sort of worked to the boundary of, that was one there, Temple Newsham House, their seams were 18 inches. I mean, men working on 18 inches high, on your knees, shovelling coal.
So from here, if you go down to these seams, hundreds of feet underground, how far away did they radiate from here at the centre of the colliery?
From Water Egg, they'd go right through to Rothwell, right to the boundary of the Rothwell colliery, and to the boundary of the Newmarket colliery, and to the boundary of the Savile colliery. So all this area that we can see now would be all the area of Water Egg, and then, of course, the other pits would take their sort of share of it. And this is why you got groups of collieries under private coal owners, like Briggs's collieries was Charles, here.
Savile? Yeah, Charlesworth's.
Well, Briggs's was
Briggs's own, Savile and Waterhead.
Yeah, and Whitwood.
And Whitwood.
And Whitwood, so they were all down this way. Then you got to the other side, it was T&RW Bowers. And as Frank says, oh, that was Charlesworth's, that went that way. And they were all had their own, probably an area of up and 5 or 6 miles was all their area for mining.
But actually, and Water Egg was actually one of the later pits, because they didn't actually sink the shaft till 1910. A lot of those other pits had been sunk in the 1850s and 1860s, hadn't they?
If you go to Rothwell Colliery, when it closed, it was one of the oldest collieries in Yorkshire, and it goes back so far that they had records of boys of 7 years old working down the pit. In fact, where the half winding wheel is, as you go into Leeds, you know, near Sturton, it gives you the date, and it's about 1860 something sort of, and say boys of 7 years old are working down the pit. And then
it was a wet colliery as well, I think, was Rothwell colliery as such was a wet, very wet.
What do you
conditions
mean?
To work in, where they worked, you'd have thought it would have been Water Egg with the name, hence Water Egg Water. But I understood that, I was always told that Rothwell Colliery was the wettest of the two.
And yet, so consequently, they had to pump a lot of water out as well.
Water out, yes. I mean, going back to when, prior nationalisation, during your granddad's days, when your granddad first came to Water Egg, he was hewing coal on his side, laid down and having to hew the coal out in the yard seam. We called it the yard seam, but that was at the coal face. It was and that was when they introduced the coal cutting machines. It was all hand hewn at one time. You used to have a shot fire, what they called a shot fire. He used to go down first and he'd drill into the coal seam a series of holes, and then it'd pack it with powder and a detonator in. They'd all have to come away from the coal face, and then he'd have his little battery charger and switch his battery on and explode the coal, and that had all dropped down. And that's when your granddad and all his mates and that, they'd have to go in with the pick and shovel and shove it onto the conveyor belt at the back of them.
You talked about these various seams. Did they mine them all at the same time? In other words, when the miners were going down in their cage, did the cage have to stop at different levels, and also the coal come out from different levels?
Yes, it had different levels that they went into, and of course the winding engineman could tell where this cage was in the shaft, and it stopped at that level.
On his big drum, where is his cable drum? It was marked off in sections where the Flockton level was. And it's an arrow, a big arrow that went round, right round. And when it got to the Flockton level, the cage, it'd stop it. It'd go down then to the next level. and it'd stop it again. Then it'd get down to the pit bottom.
How did they communicate from the cage back to the top?
With signals.
Just by what they call raps on a bell, and by numbers. One rap meant something, two ding-dings meant something else, and three ding-dings, and that's all he couldn't see anything that was happening with the cages. He just worked on what those, as they call them, raps were. And it was absolutely fascinating that how accurate that they were, and not seeing anything, and able to control something like that. But it was very important, was the pit, for the quality of coal. For all the mills in Lancashire and Yorkshire, where we stood now, if for some reason there was a breakdown on the screens where they screened the coal, or down the pit, and because there was no coal available, from where we stood, right down, right past those houses, right down into Woodlesford, there would be lorries just waiting for coal. And that was every day. In fact, there used to be five lorries used to take coal to Bradford Woolcombers, and they used to do about three trips a day, and the drivers every day run a sweepstake between all five of them, and the one who could get the most loads to the maximum amount of weight, he won the sweep that day. And that's how they used to do it. But it used to go all into Lancashire and all over. And I mean, it was a good quality coal.